This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents 8 Weeks to Optimum Health, a proven program for taking full advantage of your body's natural healing power, by Andrew Weil, M.D., read by Stephen Hoy. Part 1. The Capacity to Change. Chapter 1. People Can Change. You have in your hands a tool for changing your life, an 8-week program for improving health and gaining access to the power of spontaneous healing in your body. I will guide you through this program step by step, explaining the changes I will ask you to make in how you eat, how you exercise, how you breathe, and how you use your mind. I will recommend vitamins, minerals, and herbs you can use to protect your body's healing system. And I will give you ideas about how you can change long-standing patterns of behavior that impair optimal health. Maybe you have picked up this book because you want to have more energy. Maybe you want to lose some weight. Maybe you worry about getting older and developing diseases that disabled your parents. Perhaps you travel frequently and find it hard to maintain a healthy lifestyle on the road. Or perhaps you have a chronic illness, minor or major, and want to be less dependent on pharmaceutical drugs. Regardless of the specific nature of your need or concern, the information I have assembled in these pages will help you draw on your body's own resources for natural healing. The 8-week program consists of small steps that build on each other until by the time you complete it, you have laid the foundation for healthy living. You can then decide how much of the program you want to maintain on a permanent basis. I assume that you want to make changes in your life, otherwise you wouldn't be reading this book. I see my job as pointing you in the right direction. I have no doubt that you can change, because I know from my own experience that people can do so, if they really want to. In moving files recently, I came across a yellowed clipping from the New York Times of August 12, 1971, with the headline, "Meat-eating 230-pound doctor is now 175-pound vegetarian." The article was the featured story in the food, fashions, family furnishings section of that day's paper and carried the byline of Raymond A. Sokoloff, then a Times food writer. It concerns a 29-year-old physician in rural Virginia who gave up animal foods except for dairy products, with a resultant increase in energy, well-being, and overall health. There is a photograph of the doctor in his kitchen preparing fresh corn. He has a full black beard, is wearing blue jeans and a work shirt, and looks content. Next to the picture is his recipe for a rich corn soup containing milk and butter, and another recipe for a barley and vegetable casserole that calls for a 1/4 cup of peanut oil. According to the article, the doctor's interest in consciousness led him to experiment with yoga and meditation, and since yoga calls for a vegetarian diet, he gave up meat in order to really do it right. He has been vegetarian ever since, to the amazement of his friends, who remember him as a voracious meat eater and a fat person while at Harvard. In 1 year on his new diet, he has reduced his weight from 230 to 175 pounds. His recurring colds and allergies have vanished. My beard is no longer black, and I have not been able to maintain my weight at 175 pounds. I am still mostly vegetarian. I have eaten fish for the past 20 years, though now I don't make rich soups with milk and butter, use oil in such quantities, or ever cook with peanut oil. I think I am wiser with age, and in general feel much happier now than I did when I was 29. That was a watershed year for me. I had quit a frustrating job with the National Institute of Mental Health in July 1970, dropped out of professional medicine to write my first book, and made a great many changes in my way of living, besides giving up meat. For the first time ever, I lived alone in a natural setting well away from a city. I had no office to go to, no obligations to meet. I began each morning with sitting meditation for as long as I could tolerate. which was not much in those days. I took long walks in the woods, practiced yoga postures in the afternoons, wrote and read on a variety of subjects that interested me, from Native American shamanism to mushrooms and other wild foods. By August 1971, I was nearing another transition. The New York Times article noted, "Dr. Weil will be traveling to the Amazon jungle this fall for an extended visit to some primitive tribes on a fellowship from the Institute of Current World Affairs, a New York foundation." I held that fellowship from 1971 to 1975 and have written elsewhere about those travels. In another book, Spontaneous Healing, I describe seeking out a shaman in Colombia during that period and explain that my studies of ethnobotany and medicine at Harvard made me want to see the rainforest, meet native healers, and try to understand the source of healing. Mostly, I wanted to learn how to help people get well and stay well without using so many of the invasive and suppressive methods of conventional medicine. And I thought the knowledge I needed was to be found in remote mountains and jungles, far from classrooms and clinics. My plan was to go to southern Mexico to learn Spanish, then to make my way down to Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru to live with Indians and learn their ways with plants and healing. I knew this journey would be demanding, and when I first settled on the idea, I was in no way prepared, either physically or mentally, to undertake such an adventure. I had grown up in a row house in Philadelphia with little opportunity to spend time in nature, let alone in wilderness. On leaving Philadelphia, I attended college and medical school in Boston, then completed a medical internship in San Francisco, more urban indoor experience. I was not very comfortable out of doors, being nervous about insects and wary of the sun, since I had fair skin that never tanned, only burned. I accepted this as an inherited trait that could never disappear. Although I was able to concentrate enough to handle schoolwork easily, I was restless, very susceptible to boredom, and I craved distraction. I was largely sedentary, hating exercise, and since I also liked to eat, I was overweight. My diet was freeform and thoughtless. I ate anything and everything in large quantities, including very high-fat foods. I was a frequent consumer of alcohol and Coca-Cola. Though I had no significant health problems, I knew from the way I huffed and puffed climbing stairs that I was not in good cardiovascular condition. I suffered from intense pollen allergies, mostly in the summer, and also had allergic reactions to a number of medications and some foods. Sometimes I would get hives for no apparent reason. On occasion, I got bad migraines. So it was clear that I was going to have to change in order to set out by myself for unknown lands and peoples in the Andes and the Amazon Basin. Many of my friends could not imagine my doing any such thing, but I was determined to do so because I believed it was the only way for me to become a true physician, one who could work with the healing power of nature. When I think back on all the changes I made in the year before I left the United States, I do not remember their being hard, even though I had to give up lifelong habits and adopt new ways of being. My memories of that year are of much fun and discovery, along with a gratifying sense of accomplishment. When I look at before and after pictures of myself, I am amazed at the difference. Not only did I lose weight and grow a beard, I became aware of my strength and flexibility, got much more comfortable with myself and nature, and even miraculously was able to stay out in the sun and tan for the first time in my life. My allergies and headaches disappeared. By the time I got to southern Mexico, I was feeling better than I ever had in my life, full of energy, ready to plunge into unknown waters. My late friend and mentor, Norman Zinberg, a Harvard psychoanalyst, used to keep that photo of me from the New York Times, and a more recent photo, to refute those who complained to him that people could not change, and change permanently. His profession was about helping patients give up dysfunctional patterns of thought and behavior, not an easy job. As a physician and director of a university program in integrative medicine, I find myself in the same position. Patients come to me with stories of woe, and instead of giving them magical cures, I tell them they must change their diets, their habits of exercise, their ways of handling stress, even their breathing. Fortunately, the patients who come to see me are self-selected. They share my philosophy of health and healing and are highly motivated to take responsibility for their well-being. They are looking for advice about what to do, and when they get it, they will act on it. Unfortunately, most doctors deal with patients who are not so motivated and are instead looking for quick fixes, who would rather take a prescribed drug than change their behavior. But I know from my experience as a physician that many of the common complaints that people have these days respond much better to simple adjustments of lifestyle than to taking medicine. You can certainly medicate yourself regularly with painkillers if you are prone to headaches, or with antihistamines if you have allergies, anti-inflammatories if you have arthritis, or sedatives if you can't sleep. But how much better it would be to solve those problems by modifying diet and patterns of activity and rest and by using natural remedies. The 8-week program presented in this book gives you all the information you need to do that and more. Above all, it will enhance and protect your body's own healing system, which is your best defense against illness, the stress of modern life, and the assaults of a toxic environment. I do not mean to minimize the difficulty of change. Inertia is resistance to motion, action, or change, just as physical bodies at rest tend to remain at rest, whereas those in motion tend to remain in motion in a fixed course unless acted upon by external forces, so do human bodies resist change. Inertia is a general characteristic of things both living and non-living. If you have ever tried to work a block of cold modeling clay or a lump of unkneaded bread dough, you know the persistence and effort required to make them flowing and supple. In these cases, the external force comes from skilled hands, experienced at working clay and dough and overcoming their inertia. Many people want to remake their lives but cannot imagine doing so without outside help. If only some skilled hands could apply the necessary force to get them going, they could do it, but on their own they remain in habitual ruts. The answer to this common problem is motivation. The very word derives from the Latin form of the verb to move. If you are motivated to seek better health, all that you need to achieve it is practical information. The 8-week program is complete and sufficient for you to reach your goal. If you are motivated to read this book and begin the program, you need no other outside help. Let me share with you some observations about the power of motivation to break even the most stubborn of unhealthy habits, drug addiction. Over the years, I have worked with many people who struggled with addictive behavior. Smokers, drinkers, compulsive users of cocaine, heroin, coffee, and chocolate, as well as compulsive eaters, gamblers, and shoppers. I have learned that any addiction can be broken if people are motivated to do so. Even addiction to a substance like heroin, a hard drug, drops away easily when users develop sufficient motivation to stop. The trouble, of course, is that therapists and programs cannot put motivation into addicts. And many addicts who check themselves into programs or go to therapists do not really want to stop, no matter what they say. Tobacco addiction is the most common cause of preventable serious illness in our society. As a physician, I am often in the position of trying to convince smokers that they must attempt to break their addiction. As a long-time researcher of drugs and drug abuse, I know that cigarettes are the most addictive substance in the world. Nonetheless, I have known many people to quit successfully and permanently. How do they do it? Many ex-smokers made one or more unsuccessful attempts to quit before they finally did it for good. Some describe intense physical and psychological distress during their early attempts, but report that when they finally kicked the habit, there was no struggle. One man told me he woke up one day, reached for his first cigarette of the morning, and suddenly saw his stained fingers and the dirty ashtray as if for the first time. In that moment he realized he had had enough. He quit without difficulty and has never smoked since. Once I had that realization, it was easy, he remembers. I knew I would never smoke again. What do these stories tell us about the possibility of changing behavior? My interpretation of them is that motivation is the key. When it reaches a critical point, breaking even the hardest of drug addictions can be easy. How motivation develops to that point is not simple or obvious. Research into cigarette addiction indicates that making an attempt to quit is the best predictor of eventual success, even if the attempt itself is not successful. For this reason, I always ask smokers who come to see me whether they have ever made an attempt to quit, and I always urge them to set a date when they will make one. Attempting to quit is commitment to changing behavior, a measure of motivation. And whether you succeed or fail is less important than making the attempt. Even if you resume smoking in a week, you lose no credit for the effort. In fact, the effort adds to a reservoir of motivation that one day will be full enough to initiate the sudden change that enables people to drop habits without struggling. Such is the power of motivation. But it must come from within. Whether you are a therapist, counselor, friend, or relative of an addict, all you can do is give good reasons for changing behavior, along with encouragement and support. This book is all about changing behavior. You are probably not addicted to drugs, but you may have other habits that are raising your risks of disease and keeping you from experiencing optimum health. Perhaps you like high-fat foods and eat no vegetables, or never exercise, or drink too much coffee, or have unsatisfying relationships, or live with anxiety or depression. You can change your behavior in ways that will protect and enhance your body's natural healing ability, and because you are reading this book, I know that you already are motivated to do so. When I was a sedentary, overweight, allergic person who sought distraction and was uncomfortable in nature, I was able to alter my way of being completely and relatively easily because I wanted very much to do something that required me to change. I knew that I could not undertake the journey to South America as I was. It was my desire to make the trip that inspired me to work on myself. And that desire outweighed the benefits I was getting from my established patterns of living. This is an important point. If you simply condemn unwanted behavior without acknowledging what you are getting out of it, you may not be able to give it up, no matter how much harm it is causing. In order to change behavior, you must be clear about what satisfaction that behavior is giving you, as well as what it is costing you. Then make a conscious decision to move. Again, take the example of smoking. It is very easy to see it only as a dirty, unhealthy habit with nothing to recommend it. But for a smoker, cigarettes provide pleasure, relief from nervous tension, improved concentration, and feelings of well-being, even if temporary. One woman who was still in the phase of struggling with her addiction put it this way. Cigarettes are my friends, or I should say they are more like lovers. My relationship with them is deeply intimate, and the thought of never having them again desolates me just as if I were never to see a lover again. Becoming a non-smoker would have to offer a great reward indeed to compensate her for that loss. Now, it is obvious that fear can be a great motivator. The threat of imminent death can make people quit smoking readily, no matter that cigarettes are their friends and lovers. The possibility of divorce can lead spouses finally to spend more quality time with each other. Fear of flunking out of college may motivate a student to buckle down and study. So, avoidance of disaster may be more than adequate compensation for giving up a beloved habit or long-established pattern of behavior. In the example I gave from my own history, however, the reward was not avoidance of a negative outcome, but rather enjoyment of a positive one, I get to go on my Latin American adventures and have wonderful experiences that I would not trade for anything. Even though I recognize the efficacy of fear in facilitating behavioral change, I feel that seeking positive reinforcement, a reward you can enjoy, is better than pursuing negative reinforcement, avoidance of something you do not want to experience, because research shows that positive reinforcement is better at maintaining new behavior. If fear is your motivator, when fear subsides, so does motivation. Fear can also paralyze you, preventing you from moving at all. I promise that I will not try to scare you into following my 8-week program. Instead, I will describe the real rewards that await you on completing it and making it a part of your life. You will notice that I will not ask you to give up many things. I will not ask you to stop eating meat or drinking coffee or alcohol, nor will I say even a word about quitting smoking. You will not have to give up sex or chocolate on this program either. All I will ask you to do is to add positive behaviors, to strengthen and extend habits you probably already have. Habits of eating, exercising, breathing, using your mind, and nourishing your spirit. I will leave it to you to moderate or eliminate any unhealthy behavior. As you become more aware of your body's healing system and your responsibility for protecting it, I think that will happen naturally, without forcing change. To reinforce the point that people can change, I'd like to quote from letters I have received. Here first is TJ from Minnesota. 6 years ago, I'm now 27, the doctors threw the ugly C-word at me and made it sound like a death sentence. It was bone cancer. They decided that they were the authorities and I was the victim, and the only way was their way. I walked out of their offices never to return. I took up biking, about 500 miles a week, and running, about 60 miles a week, and ate fresh fruit, juices, and whole grains. Nothing else. Too bad more people out there won't acknowledge what a little self-determination and using one's subconscious can do to return a person to wholeness. I'm graduating in 6 weeks with a Bachelor of Science in Exercise Science and Physiology and my minor in Psychology. I hope to work toward developing programs for others to offer them alternative pathways toward health and wholeness. It was an inspiration to know that there are some doctors who believe that healing can come from within and not merely from them. Just how far is it from Minnesota to Arizona? I think I'll bike out there after graduation to live in a climate my joints will like a little better. The next letter is from Barbara Levy Daniels, a counselor from Williamsville, New York. I am a 50-year-old healthy female who has been seeking medical advice for a rheumatoid-like condition for the past 12 years. With each attempt, Western doctors told me I had rheumatoid arthritis and that the most conservative treatment was anti-inflammatory medications. These did nothing to relieve my swollen joints or my intense fatigue. It became apparent to me over the years that most doctors had no idea how to help me other than to give out medicines. They never asked me about diet, vitamins, or exercise. Now I have eliminated dairy products, artificial sweeteners, caffeine, and acidic fruits and eat a vegetarian diet. I have followed your simple vitamin formula and have had several acupuncture treatments. I have continued daily exercise and have a massage from a massage therapist about once a month. I have followed this routine for approximately 5 months and find myself much improved. The morning fatigue is mostly gone, as is the multiple joint pain. I feel like my old self again. If more doctors practiced in this way, the costs of health care could be reduced. And this from Shelley Griffith of Messina, New York. I was on a program of my own due to the tragic suicide death of my 20-year-old son, which took my health down the tubes. Then I ran across your book when I was searching for advice to bring my physical body back to good alignment. Bingo. I was going to a standard practitioner, by the way, and I am never going back. Your consciousness-raising methods are so ahead of Western, sterile, non-spiritual methodology, anyone with any sense of the greater picture will take heed. So, I started going to places with spiritual energy, went on retreats, visited shrines, did healing ceremonies. This brought me the ability to give up my pain that had soaked deeply into my physical body. I needed the 8-week program to get rid of accumulated toxicity. I brought flowers indoors, did away with all vegetable oils, brought in extra virgin olive oil, worked with garlic, excellent and easy for me because I'm Italian-French, and I went to the health food store for organic flours, grains, and beans. I decreased animal protein and bought green tea. I take echinacea and practice news fasts. My personal development has been super, with renewed energy. The deep breathing has almost eliminated the grief, pain, and anxiety. Depression has lessened considerably. My weight has dropped, my chest pain has disappeared, and my circulatory system is back in balance. I also take some of the tonics you recommend, especially ginger and dong quai. I'm learning all I can. Since this book was first published, thousands of people have completed and continue to follow the 8-week program. Many of them began this process on the Internet, and drweil.com still offers My Optimum Health Plan, MOHP, a very popular way to join others online and work through the steps. I've received letters from people all over the world about their successes and their sense of loss when their 8-week virtual communities came to an end. Here are two recent examples. Jen Mosaic, a writer from Mendocino, California, says the program has left no part of her life untouched. Before, I always thought of healthful eating in terms of denial. I don't eat red meat, I don't eat fatty foods, so I'm eating healthfully. The plan showed me a more positive way to think about food. It's more about embracing the good things, the fruits and vegetables, the antioxidants, the good fats, than it is about avoiding what's bad. Along with the diet, I take supplements, including immune support with mushrooms and astragalus. I used to get sick once a month. Now it's more like once a year, if that. Embracing exercise was another big change. I really did not do it at all before, but now I try to walk every day for 45 minutes, with swinging arms. I call it the Wild Walk. When the weather is bad, I use a videotape. That's sort of a combination of dancing and walking, which works really well. I have a bad back, so I really got into yoga. When I go into back spasm, it is the one thing that really helps. I also have respiratory issues. I had asthma as a child, and my mother died of emphysema. Dr. Weil advises you to write down your family history, so I did, and decided to focus on breathing by doing the exercises. What a difference! I feel so alive now, and much of it I attribute to the breathing. Spiritually, I now consider myself a Buddhist. The meditation, the yoga, the breathing exercises, they all fit into that tradition, and I started all of it through Dr. Weil. I have searched spiritually all my life. Buddhism is the one thing that has made sense to me. There are two really big things I want to emphasize. The first is that I feel one of the greatest gifts I have gotten is the ability to pass all of this along to my daughter. When she was here at home, she did many of the exercises and absorbed the philosophy and, of course, ate the food. Now that she's at college, it's clear that the change is permanent. She calls me up all the time and says, "The dorm food is just awful. I'm going out this afternoon to get some more organic stuff." Also, I was raised in a dysfunctional family, and I never felt it was right to take care of myself. It would never have occurred to me on my own to pick flowers for my home just so that I could enjoy them. I was raised to think that was selfish. But Dr. Weil showed me that you can't give to others if you yourself are miserable all the time. It's only through caring for yourself that you can have enough energy and grace and health to share with the world. To realize that is a miracle for me. Maya Smith, preschool teacher, Toronto. When I was 50 years old, I was going through a stage in my life where I suppose you could say I felt sort of disconnected. I was overweight and pimply with rosacea. I went to lunch with some friends, and someone took a picture. When the picture came back, I thought, my gosh, who is this person? I look terrible. What happened here? Not only didn't I like what I saw physically, but my eyes looked vacant, as if I had no spirit. I guess I had been so busy with other things that I had neglected myself. My concern was not just vanity. My father had died of a heart attack at age 52, and my brother had died of complications from diabetes at age 63. My mother also has many chronic ailments such as arthritis and diverticulosis. I wanted to grow old healthily and feel in control. Well, around that time I was walking the dog. It's a big dog. And he ran into me and broke my leg. While I was in physical therapy, I started reading a lot of books and searching the internet, and I found out about 8 weeks to optimum health. It covered all the areas I wanted to change. I followed it week by week and have kept with the program ever since. Over the next 2 years, I lost more than 35 pounds without dieting. This year, I will turn 60, and I have kept that weight off by continuing to follow Dr. Weil's recommendations. I think I am younger at 60 than I was at 50. My rosacea has disappeared. I have much more energy. I sailed through menopause without drugs. It was not a problem at all, not one hot flash. I am a member of the Taoist Tai Chi Society, and I walk my dog a great deal for the exercise for both of us. I went in for a bone scan not long ago. They said I had the bones of a 20-something-year-old. In terms of diet, I cut down on meat, dairy, and pasta. My family went to more fruits and vegetables, soy products, whole grains, olive oil, salmon, just what is in the book. It has actually been wonderful for all of us. My husband is the cook in the family. He cooks 90% of the meals. And all of us, including my grown kids, love to eat well. I believe too much pasta and refined carbs were a good deal of the problem. Now we eat whole grain pasta perhaps once a week. I also generally follow Dr. Wild's supplement advice. We live outside Toronto, where winter is a long season. We welcome spring and love to have potted tulips and daffodils in the house and, later on, cut flowers from the garden and nearby fields. So we enjoy flowers and make an effort to have them in the home. The book has a lot of good advice about handling stress, and I have made good use of that. I have become quite active on the message boards at www.drweil.com and have met some wonderful, like-minded people. One person even came from Chile to Toronto, so we met in person. I also email others regularly. What I like about the plan is that it is a step-by-step process, and at every step there was something to feel good about. It was not like you had to wait 8 weeks for the payoff. As I went through it, and even afterward, I could feel everything gradually coming into balance, the physical, mental, and spiritual sides. It changed who I was. I feel great and in control. I truly feel grateful to Dr. Weil. I will try to accomplish 3 things in the pages that follow. First, I want to share with you my vision of the body's healing system and encourage you to rely on it in all matters concerning your health. Second, I want to convince you of the importance of developing a healthy lifestyle and the possibility of doing so quickly and easily. Third, I want to give you very specific suggestions about those aspects of lifestyle that I consider most important to health and healing. I know that I cannot motivate you to undertake the 8-week program. You must do that yourself. But since you have read this far, I believe you are already interested in moving forward. And I will assume that you now want to know what moving forward entails and how to do it. Chapter 2. An Overview of Health and Healing. Health is wholeness and balance. an inner resilience that allows you to meet the demands of living without being overwhelmed. If you have that kind of resilience, you can experience the inevitable interactions with germs and not get infections. You can be in contact with allergens and not suffer allergies. And you can sustain exposure to carcinogens and not get cancer. Optimal health should also bring with it a sense of strength and joy, so that you experience it as more than just the absence of disease. I designed the 8-week program to lead you to that experience and show you how to maintain it. Perfect health is not possible. Beware of people and products that promise it. Health is a dynamic and temporary state of equilibrium destined to break down as conditions change, but most of the breakdowns need not be major. The point is that health is not static. It is normal to lose it periodically in order to come back to it in a better way. Whenever the equilibrium of the body breaks down, your healing system attempts to reestablish it. In other words, healing is an automatic process activated by any breakdown in health. When you cut your finger, for example, you do not have to pray for the cut to heal or seek out a finger healer. As long as the wound is clean and no underlying chronic illness is present, the cut heals by itself. That is an example of spontaneous healing, mediated by the healing system. The healing system is a functional system of the body, not a structural component like the nervous system or the musculoskeletal system. Western medicine focuses more on structure than on function, with the result that conventional doctors learn a great deal about the body's structural systems and less about functional ones. Of course, in some cases, digestion and circulation, for example, structure and function are synonymous, but because the healing system does not correlate neatly with any one set of body structures, I cannot provide a line drawing of it in the way that I could of the digestive system. The function of healing depends on the operation of all the systems known to Western medicine. It also draws on the mind and other non-physical components of our being. To see the difference between looking at the body as a set of associated structures versus a set of interdependent functions, it is instructive to contrast Eastern medical science with Western. Traditional Chinese medicine developed thousands of years ago in a sophisticated culture that pioneered the discovery and orderly use of medicinal plants and invented a unique therapeutic modality, acupuncture, that is now widely practiced throughout the world. For a variety of cultural reasons, one being the unthinkability of dissecting a dead body, Chinese medicine also developed without detailed knowledge of the internal structure of the human body. Instead, it concentrated on identifying body functions and clarifying their relationships to one another. One key function, identified long ago by Eastern medical science, is defense. That is, the body has the need and ability to defend itself against threats to its equilibrium, whether they be physical, emotional, or energetic. Having noted and studied the body's defensive capabilities, Chinese doctors then explored the natural world to find ways of maintaining and enhancing them, and they discovered a number of ways to do so, including the administration of herbal remedies. Among these remedies are ginseng, astragalus, and several mushrooms that grow on trees, such as Ganoderma lucidum, known to the Chinese as Ling Qi, and the Japanese as Reishi. Chinese doctors knew little of the nature of the organs that Western medicine now considers parts of the immune system. They did not connect tonsils, adenoids, the lymph nodes, appendix, thymus, and spleen with the body's defensive sphere of function. But that lack of anatomical knowledge did not obstruct their practical ability to improve the health of their patients. On the other hand, Western doctors described the structural nature of the immune organs, but had no idea of their function until very recently. For much of the 20th century, they labeled most of them functionless, vestigial, or unimportant. Even when I was a student at Harvard Medical School in the late 1960s, It was commonplace for surgeons to remove tonsils and adenoids from most children who had frequent episodes of tonsillitis. Until very recently, many patients who entered the hospital for abdominal surgery, gallbladder removals or hysterectomies, for example, had their appendix removed routinely and without their consent, often not finding out that the removal had taken place until they got their hospital bill. In the 1950s, doctors in leading medical centers recklessly injured the thymus glands of children with X-rays. These physicians invented a disease, thymic hypertrophy, that every child had, and pronounced it curable by shrinking the gland with X-ray treatments. A hypertrophic organ is one that is too large. The thymus is large in childhood because it is doing vital work for the developing immune system, programming lymphocytes to recognize foreign antigens. Doctors in the 1950s did not understand that function. They believed the thymus was a useless organ whose large size in childhood indicated some disease process. Here is a stark contrast between a functional versus a structural view of the human body. Western medical structuralists carelessly destroyed immune organs, whereas Eastern functionalists developed practical methods to improve their operation. Research on the effects of the Chinese medicinal mushrooms in animals and humans shows them to stimulate immune function. For example, Ganoderma increases immune destruction of tumor cells and virus-infected cells, effects that are especially desirable in view of Western medicine's relative inability to treat cancer and viral infections successfully. When I look at the body from a functional perspective, I see that defense is actually one component of a superfunction that I call healing. In spontaneous healing, I try to convey a sense of the manifold operations of the healing system, pointing out, for example, that even at the most fundamental level of life, the DNA molecule that encodes genetic information and directs all cellular processes, it is possible to observe an inherent ability to recognize injury or malfunction, to remove damaged structure, and to regenerate intact structure. If a strand of DNA is damaged, say by an energetic ultraviolet ray from the sun, the molecule identifies the point of injury and repairs it by manufacturing specific repair enzymes to do the job. The healing system operates from that fundamental level up to the level of cut fingers and into the mental realm, where it helps us adjust to emotional shocks. It operates continually, keeping most of us in good health most of the time, despite all the agents of illness and forces of disorder that surround us constantly, and it is always at the ready to help us deal with serious threats to health when they arise. To illustrate the potential for healing, a subject that conventional medical teaching, research, and practice largely ignore, by the way, I presented a number of cases in spontaneous healing from my experience with people who underwent dramatic reversals of life-threatening diseases like aplastic anemia and metastatic kidney cancer, as well as more commonplace conditions like arthritis and back pain. Since the publication of that book, I have gathered many more healing stories, some from people who roused their healing systems to action by following the kinds of advice presented in the 8-week program that is the subject of this book. I will recount some of those tales throughout this book to help motivate you to undertake the program and follow it through to its conclusion, a new and improved lifestyle that will increase your chances of enjoying optimum health into old age. I also continue to scan the medical literature for evidence that my profession is beginning to take an interest in this type of healing. For now, I see just the merest beginnings of movement. But I did come across a remarkable report in the July 1996 issue of the journal Nature Genetics that I want to share with you. According to a team of researchers at New York University School of Medicine, Jordan Houghton, a young boy from Michigan with an inherited fatal disease of the immune system, should have been dead by age 4, but was alive and in excellent health at age 13, not because of medical treatment, but because his body somehow repaired the faulty genes he got from both parents. The disease, known as ADA deficiency, is a rare condition, occurring in about 1 in a million births. It killed the patient's brother at 18 months. The defective genes failed to produce a functioning version of ADA, a vital enzyme needed to eliminate substances that can poison immune cells. Lacking that natural defense, the immune system is crippled, leaving ADA-deficient children susceptible to overwhelming infections from infancy. Medical doctors attempt to treat them by administering injections of the missing enzyme or by performing bone marrow transplants, as well as by using aggressive antibiotic therapy to contain the infections. Like his brother, who died 4 years before he was born, Jordan had many infections in infancy and grew slowly. Examination of his blood cells clearly showed that he had inherited defective copies of the key gene from both his mother and father. But by age 2, Jordan began responding well to conventional medication, whereas his brother had not. Jordan never needed enzyme injections or a bone marrow transplant, and around age 5, he suddenly started doing very well. When the article appeared, he was a very active teenager and an A student who hardly ever got colds. Some of his blood cells still showed the faulty genes, but in some, only the copy inherited from his father was flawed, and the maternal gene was normal. Jordan's healing system managed to make a precise repair in the maternal gene, perhaps in just one blood cell initially. That cell was then able to multiply until Jordan's body could produce enough of the normal enzyme to permit his immune system to function correctly. Talk about spontaneous healing! Of course, events like this are extremely rare, but I insist on taking them into account in trying to develop a picture of the full potential of the human healing system. When I look at common ailments, headaches, allergies, sinus conditions, digestive disorders, back pain, anxiety, I find healing to be the rule rather than the exception. Most illnesses are self-limited. They come to an end, just as a cut finger heals, because the healing system is able to handle most problems and restore the balance of health. When illness persists, the healing system is blocked, stalled, or overwhelmed and needs help. The true purpose of medicine is to facilitate healing. The aim of treatment should be to unblock the healing system and allow it to do its work. Please keep in mind the distinction between healing and treatment. Treatment originates from outside, whereas healing comes from within. Let me quote from Spontaneous Healing. Suppose I come down with bacterial pneumonia, a serious, possibly life-threatening infection of the lungs. I go to a hospital, receive intravenous antibiotics, recover, and am discharged, cured. What caused the cure? Most people, doctors and patients alike, would say it was the treatment. But I want you to consider a different interpretation. Antibiotics reduce the numbers of invading germs to a point where the immune system can take over and finish the job. The real cause of the cure is the immune system, which may be unable to end an infection because it is overwhelmed by sheer numbers of bacteria and whatever toxic products they might make. Of course, the immune system is itself a component of the healing system. I maintain that the final common cause of all cures is the healing system, whether or not treatment is applied. When treatments work, they do so by activating innate healing mechanisms. Treatment, including drugs and surgery, can facilitate healing and remove obstacles to it, but treatment is not the same as healing. The best treatment is the least invasive, least drastic, least expensive, that activates spontaneous healing. And prevention always supersedes treatment in importance. Whether the focus of prevention is external, as in disinfecting drinking water, or internal, as in taking antioxidant supplements and natural tonics that boost immunity, preventing disease is always easier, less expensive, and surer than treating disease. So important that you must learn how to do it. You may go on the 8-week program for any of a number of good reasons. To feel better, to get more energy, to lose weight, for instance. But its ultimate purpose is to reduce your risks of premature illness and death by enhancing the performance of your body's healing system. A friend who was just turning 40 once lamented to me that he was getting to the age when bodies break down. "I think the human body comes with a 40-year warranty," he told me. "And after that, it starts to go to hell." I replied that I thought the body was designed for considerably longer service. But he countered that in his world, large numbers of his contemporaries were dropping. "Every time the phone rings, I hear about someone else just diagnosed with cancer," he went on. "Or if it's not cancer, it's something else you don't want to have." There is no doubt that many men and women have their first serious brush with disastrous loss of health in middle age. But I believe many of the disasters could be averted because they are diseases of lifestyle, products of years of failing to eat wisely, exercise appropriately, or treat body and mind in ways that protect the healing system. In one sense, it is too bad that younger bodies are so forgiving. People in their teens, 20s, and early 30s can get away with eating quantities of fast food, with using stimulants and depressants, carousing and abusing their bodies in all the ways our society seems to encourage. What I think happens around age 40, however, is not that the warranty runs out, but that the bill comes due. That is, the cumulative effects of unhealthy habits and patterns of living make themselves known for the first time as the natural resilience of the body inevitably begins to diminish. If young people could immediately feel the consequences of their lifestyle, I am sure most of them would clean up their act early on. As it is, many see no reason to change, and some are shocked to discover that their bodies can suddenly fail in middle age. Actually, I think most bodies come with warranties for 80 years of productive, relatively trouble-free service, if basic requirements for preventive maintenance are followed. I have incorporated those requirements into the 8-week program. If you complete it and make the core concepts part of your ongoing lifestyle, you will greatly reduce your risk of falling into the common traps that kill and disable people prematurely, leading to heart disease or cancer contracted in what should be the prime of life. Nonetheless, it is certain that every one of us, sooner or later, will face a health crisis. And many of us will have to deal with doctors, hospitals, and all the contrivances of modern medicine. The question is not if such a crisis will occur, but when. By making the 8-week program part of your life, you can increase the likelihood that the when will be later rather than sooner. Still, I want to tell you why I think it is important to anticipate health crises and prepare for them. An acquaintance of mine, a writer in his early 40s, finally decided to do something about the digestive symptoms he had ignored for almost 2 years. He had had persistent heartburn, stomach upsets, reflux, and intolerance to foods and drinks that he used to be able to enjoy. Despite the urgings of family and friends, he refused to see a doctor, lived on antacids, and tried to wish his symptoms away. Only when he could no longer swallow without difficulty did he visit a physician, and the news he got quickly turned from bad to worse. Endoscopic examination revealed a tumor mass near the lower end of his esophagus. A biopsy confirmed the suspicion that it was esophageal cancer, and he was scheduled for immediate surgery to remove the tumor and check for spread. Esophageal cancer is one of the hardest forms of cancer to treat. Very few people who have it are alive 5 years after diagnosis. Now I watched an unhappy and familiar scene unfold. The patient, who was of course terrified, found himself at the center of a drama in which family, friends, and health professionals came at him with their own agendas and their own ideas as to what was best for him. His younger sister, a yoga instructor and vegetarian, put him on a raw foods diet and tried to get him to go with her to an alternative cancer treatment center in Mexico. His wife, the daughter of a cardiologist, forbade him to do so and implored him to place his trust in the oncologists at the prestigious medical institution in New York where he was to undergo surgery. His friends inundated him with inspirational books about healing. One gave him a tome on Taoist philosophy with the admonition that he must read it before his surgery. Another friend downloaded information from the internet about alternative treatments for esophageal cancer. I told the patient to try to find a hypnotherapist who could prepare him for the operation, particularly to make an audio tape with healing suggestions that he could listen to in the operating room while under anesthesia. But surgery was just 2 days away. How could he find a hypnotherapist in time? I describe this scene as unhappy because it is impossible to make careful decisions about life and death matters in the midst of such turmoil, with so many people pulling on you in different directions. This man was going to have to decide quickly whether to take the conventional treatments that would be pressed on him by oncologists after his surgery, or whether to entrust himself to alternative therapies. He needed good advice about how to live with the diagnosis of cancer, how to eat, how to use his mind to help his healing system. But where was he going to get this practical information? Probably not in a volume of Taoist philosophy. Not only was he adrift with his own fear and ignorance, he was losing his autonomy with every step he took toward the operating room, and he was growing more confused by the day as he listened to all the conflicting stories from relatives, friends, and doctors. I describe this scene as familiar because I have seen it too many times. Most people find themselves completely unprepared for major health crises and wind up scrambling desperately to maintain autonomy and develop sensible plans of action. Please try to prevent this from happening to you by thinking through in advance. Now, while you are in good health, how you want to be treated when your health is in the balance, and who you want to be in your inner circle of advisors. It is not too soon to be looking for a physician who knows conventional medicine and is open to using alternative treatments, for a skilled guided imagery therapist or hypnotherapist, for a practitioner of traditional Chinese medicine, or for other people you would like to have on your support team. Nor is it too early to begin learning techniques that will help you maintain equanimity through trying circumstances, such as breath control, meditation, and cultivation of calmness and acceptance of change. The 8-week program includes aspects that will help you in this direction. I have designed it to be preventive in a very broad sense. It gives you the information you need to keep your healing system in optimal working order so that you can stay healthy as you encounter the obstacles and challenges of day-to-day life. It shows you how to build a lifestyle that will protect you from premature disability and death. It teaches practices and skills that will enable you to prepare body, mind, and spirit for any eventual health crises you may face. Start it now and reap the benefits for the rest of your life. A Healing Story. Defying a Prognosis. Heather Thompson of Eugene, Oregon, sent me this account. In 1984, when I was 23 years old, after being told by several gynecologists that I merely had PMS, I was finally diagnosed with a grapefruit-sized endometrial tumor that had ripped my uterus and ovaries from their moorings, leaving them in the bottom of my abdominal cavity. I required surgery and then used Depo-Provera, an injectable synthetic form of progesterone, for 1 year at the insistence of my surgeon. After that year, feeling freaked out and with a sense that tumors were growing again, I quit taking the pharmaceuticals and went to a nutritionist who diagnosed me with a severe candida yeast infection. I changed my diet accordingly, began to take chlorella, an algae supplement, to clean out the pharmaceutical buildup, and began to answer the question, if I didn't have this disease at birth, what started it? Hormones in milk and meat, I suspect, and being treated with repeated doses of antibiotics as a teenager, among other things. I now consume only the purest food, water, and air, and I've been in perfect health for 10 years now, better than any time since I was a preteen. When stresses get too much, and it feels as though adhesions may be present, I go to my acupuncturist, and afterward I notice a marked improvement. The prognosis given to me by my surgeon was, you will have several more surgeries in the next 5 to 10 years. You will be in pain a great deal. You will probably never conceive, and you definitely won't be able to sustain a pregnancy. Giving birth would be a miracle. We just left your ovaries and uterus in case we discover a cure for endometriosis. Well, it's amazing what natural remedies can do. 12 years after the surgery, with a clean diet and a little assistance from Mother Nature, including herbal remedies from raspberry and nettles, my body is now ready to conceive and carry a baby to term. Chapter 3. The Whole Picture. Human beings are bodies, minds, and spirits. Health necessarily involves all of those components, and any program intended to improve health must address all of them. Conventional medicine pays almost exclusive attention to our physical bodies, giving lip service to our minds but not really taking them seriously, and totally ignoring our spirits. In spite of a great deal of research demonstrating the causative role of stress in illness and the interplay of emotions and immunity, most medical researchers and practitioners assume that physical causes can explain all diseases, and that physical treatments, drugs usually, are the only ones that count. I include under the heading mind